Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here as we approach the fall equinox in just a few days. I guess this Wednesday, the 23rd of September, we'll have our halfway point between the summer solstice and the winter solstice. So we're moving into the dark half of the year. So fall time's kind of exciting time. The storm's coming in and had some interesting weather this weekend, some heavy rains at times, and then followed up by showers with even a little bit of hail I saw a couple times. So kind of interesting weather to get out in, but also nice weather to have a warm, dry house to be in and be out of the elements. So I've been a little busy myself, haven't had as much chance to get out as I might like, but still getting out a little bit, and definitely appreciating the folks who have had a chance, have been getting out and are sharing photos and sending emails about those things that they're seeing out there. Kind of moving into the end of the small songbird migration, the warblers and so forth are starting to kind of trail off, and still quite a few sparrows around, I think, and it's a little early yet for our winter resident waterfowl to be moving through. I think the shorebirds, most of the shorebirds have probably moved through as well. So it's time, things are still moving. It's a good time of year. Sometimes rare birds will show up, young birds that went the wrong direction and are a little bit lost. So you never know what you might see out there. It's a good time to be out and looking. So if you do find anything, I'd be interested to hear about it. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. You can leave messages or post photos if you have them. Also, if you're interested in recordings of past shows, you can go to sitkanature.org/raven and find links there. I'd like to go ahead and introduce the conversation I have for this week. A couple of weeks ago, I had the chance to talk to Noah Siegel and Alyssa Allen. They were in town as part of the Natural History Seminar Series and with some support from a grant, I think the Stunts Foundation for Alyssa. And Alyssa did a workshop on mycopigments, and Noah did a talk and a walk on the weekend. And so it was great to have a chance to visit with them. I appreciate them taking some time out of their trip here to speak about mushrooms. Noah has been traveling around looking at mushrooms for a long time and photographing them. He's been working on a book on mushrooms of the West Coast, mostly focused on the Northern California into Southern Oregon, but with a lot of overlap and species here. This was his first time in Sitka, actually both their first times in Sitka, although they have been regular or have been to the Girdwood Fungus Festival at least a couple of times previously. So this conversation worked out to kind of be in two parts. So the first part, I speak with Noah, and then later I speak with Alyssa. And we'll join this conversation where I've just asked Noah about the book that he's been working on.
So it's Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast, and the Redwood Coast is from Monterey County in California up about, I mean, redwoods go about 6 miles into Oregon. And mm-hmm. They just go into the southwest tip of Oregon. So this was like 6 years ago now. Christian Schwartz, who's a young mycologist in Santa Cruz, and myself decided to do this book for Northern California. And we chose to specialize on that region, you know, just do a really comprehensive guide for that region. And it's a really diverse region. So we just chose the Redwood region as a bioregion to cover. It's not just mushrooms of the redwoods. It's mushrooms of all the different habitats that occur within that zone. And that zone is pretty much, it's a coastal strip in California. It's from the west side of the Coast Range, and in some places it's like 10 miles wide or so. Just, you know, this western strip, this really wet, rainy strip that doesn't go too high up. Redwoods make it up to about 2,000 feet in elevation. And they continue down south in the southern part of the range. It, you know, kind of runs into this chaparral shrub and live oak woodlands. And through most of the central part of the range, it's mixed Douglas fir, tan oak, madrone forest. And then the north coast is really similar to here. So that's the Sitka spruce, western hemlock. There's some grand fir there as well. Mm-hmm. And so the far north coast of California, a lot of those mushrooms there you have here.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah. So the sort of the temperate coastal rainforest, you're looking at the southern extent of that, that's along the west coast of North America. And we're sort of towards the northern end. I guess it peters out basically on the southern Kenai Peninsula. It's kind of the end of that forest. But the spruce in particular, the spruce and hemlock go down into Oregon and just a little bit of Northern California.
So hemlock makes it down to Sonoma County.
Okay.
And Spruce makes it down to central Mendocino County, but you don't get the large spruce forest until like central Humboldt County.
Oh, okay.
So kind of like the Lost Coast regions where you start picking up spruce, and like the really nice spruce forests start in northern Humboldt County, and then, you know, up through coastal Oregon, Washington, and, you know, BC up to here. The mushrooms, a lot of the like Pacific Northwest mushrooms, they're through South Central Alaska, but a lot of them disappear, and, you know, they start dropping off, and nobody knows exactly where they drop off, but Cordova doesn't have a lot of the Pacific Northwest species. Like, your Pacific Golden Chanterelle disappears about Juneau. So kind of, you know, the northern part of the southeast. And that's where it seems that a lot of the Pacific Northwest fungi start disappearing, and you start getting less and less of them, and you get more into this northern boreal forest, you know, habitat. But it's still the, you know, the thickest spruce western hemlock forest. So the mushrooms start to change, you know, as you go further north. But this region here, based on what I've seen the past few days, I don't think I've seen anything here that I haven't seen in California.
Oh, okay.
So that's really similar. Yeah. I mean, it's a snapshot of right. what actually grows here, because, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time. But what I've seen so far is it's all stuff I'm familiar with from down there.
Yeah, and I suppose you know, relative abundances may be different in part.
And that's true everywhere you
go.
Even within a small range.
Right. Yeah, and so I guess, you know, I'm not really sure. I know that some fungi are closely associated with certain species or groups of trees, you know, hardwoods versus soft, you know, conifers or even just specific species of trees or plants. And so if the plant doesn't occur, then the mushroom won't occur or the fungus won't occur. But I guess I don't know what else is driving sort of the, you know, ranges of fungi, you know, if it's temperature maybe makes a difference, or, you know, I don't know if there's any sense of what sort of things besides just species associations.
Yeah, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
Fungal ecology is really poorly understood.
Yeah.
So, and fungal range is really poorly understood. So, you know, what the Pacific Golden Chanterelle, you know, that's one of the most abundant fungi on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. Mostly growing with Douglas fir down there, but it, you know, does occur in the spruce hemlock forest and continues, you know, up through BC. But why does it start? I mean, it's not all that common around here.
Mm-hmm.
And why does it start disappearing? Why does it not occur further north and the trees are still there? Nobody really knows. I mean, it probably has to do with the amount of moisture and the amount of really cold days. I mean, it freezes up north to here, and not necessarily like a really deep hard freeze for prolonged periods here.
Yeah.
So that could have something to do with it. You know, it could just be a warmer climate that's needed for this mushroom. But yeah, I mean, what makes mushrooms tick, you know, why are they growing in one spot and not another spot in really similar habitats? I mean, you can have the same type of trees in one area, similar forest type, but not never see these mushrooms. And all of that's still pretty much unknown. It's a really unknown field.
Yeah. It seems like it would be, I'm not even sure how you'd, I mean, I don't know how hard it is to culture some of these in a lab where you could start to say, oh, it's cold is killing this thing, or heat is killing this thing, or something like that. It seems like a lot of these, I mean, I suppose it really depends on the species, but especially one of the mycorrhizal ones, I imagine you have to be able to grow the thing that it's growing with.
Yeah, and they're pretty much impossible to grow in a laboratory setting.
Yeah, yeah. So makes it a little hard to do experiments to see, I suppose. So teasing out some of those answers might be a little bit difficult at best, I suppose. And I guess so. You know, my understanding of fungal ecology is I could say fairly rudimentary. So you have a mycorrhizal fungi, and then there's the rotting ones that do all the rotting work. And I suppose, again, there, I don't know. It seems like maybe some of them are associated with some either kinds of trees. I don't know if there's specific species ones or more that tends to be more groups.
Yeah, if there's something in the woods, there's a fungus that specializes in decaying it pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of fungi which will only grow on a single host or a single part. So there's Distrobolaris occidentalis, which is a little mushroom that grows out of spruce cones.
Oh, right.
And so it's only found on the cones of Sitka spruce. And it's been reported from Western hemlock as well on the cones, but I've never seen it on that.
Yeah.
And so you have these, you know, these specialty rotters that, you know, that's their habitat. They're breaking down spruce cones. And then you have better ones like the Fomentopsis panicula, which is called bear bread around here.
Right, yeah. One of several things that kind of get lumped into the bear's bread.
Yeah, these big, large, woody polypores on trees. Yeah. Those, a lot of those are not picky at all. So the Fomentopsis can be on hardwoods or conifers.
Yeah.
A lot of the wood decay fungi do pick one of the better. They're either on conifers or on hardwoods, but some of them are just more widespread and not picky.
Yeah.
And then certain ones will only be on a single kind of, you know, or a single family. So there's some that only grow on hemlock or stuff that'll only grow on spruce.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating to me. And again, this is probably one of those things that it'd be fun to know, but probably nobody knows the sort of like, how does something get to the point where it only works on like spruce cones? And it seems fascinating just to think about that sort of process of adaptation and specialization, I guess, that goes on there. Or the mummy berry monolinia, I think, that works with, and I find those berries, blueberries and stuff all the time. I've been collecting them the last couple of years in hopes of getting them, the fungus, to fruit in the, like, just leave them out and see if it'll fruit in the spring. So far, no luck, but maybe next spring. But I've seen the fungal fruits, just little cup thing that comes out of the ones I found were actually cranberries in the muskeg. But I read an article about that a while back, that there's like, that's a very sophisticated system that those fungi use to infect the flowers and the plant.
Yeah, infect the flowers, mummify the fruit, produce discorotia, go underground, you know, overwinter underground the fruit with their, you know, their sexual fruiting structure, the cup, in the spring.
Yeah.
So it's the tip of the iceberg for the complexity of fungal, you know, fruiting and life cycle.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things which are like that or even more complex.
Yeah. I guess the other complicated ones that I've heard a little bit about are the rusts, where they have to like switch between hosts at different times of their life and life cycle. And again, it's just sort of fascinating to think how does that ever come to be in that way? I don't know how anybody would ever be able to like tell in the end, but
opportunity and so, you know, why have these things adapted to these niches? Well, the opportunity was there and nobody else was taking advantage of it.
Yeah.
So to go back about, the really specialized fungi, so there's stuff that, you know, a lot of these wood decayers are generalists. So if there's wood there to rot, they're rotting it. And then, you know, you get into the more elaborate, you know, mycorrhizal fungi, the fungi growing symbiotically with the trees in the area, which are, you know, these ectomycorrhizal fungi. And it's a relationship where the fungus kind of like goes in, attaches to the root tips, and then they exchange nutrients. The fungus gets sugars the trees producing through photosynthesis. The mushrooms picking up minerals and water from the soil, giving that to the tree. So, it's a really complex kind of like web of life going on underground that we don't even think about. But without that, the trees wouldn't be living here.
Yeah.
So you have all of that going on. You have a lot of these fungi, which will only grow of a certain kind of tree. Stuff like the pine trees have these slippery jacks or sewillus or rhizopogon, which is a kind of false truffle. And so a lot of those will only grow with either a single kind of pine or a single group of pines. So two needle pines versus three needle pines versus five. They all have their own set of specialized mycorrhizal partners. And so they're all, you know, all these fungi are providing the trees with nutrients that they wouldn't otherwise be getting. And in exchange, the fungi are getting sugars the trees producing. And kind of like in this whole connected, you know, web of life going on, and it's working for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, it's worth keeping in mind for folks that aren't as fully aware of this, that, you know, what we see and call mushrooms, is they're really just a small part of the actual organism of the fungus.
Yeah, it's the fruiting structure of a much, much larger thing.
Yeah.
And so it's all, you know, it's all going on underground or in substrate. You know, your rotten log has all these, it's like this mycelial network, which is this microscopic chain of cells that are all tied together. And so that's the whole structure of the fungus. And then when you see the bare bread, the conch, the, you know, the fruiting structure coming off of it, that's just the fruiting body.
Yeah.
I mean, the easiest way to picture it is, you know, to take your spruce tree and not only bury the roots, the branches, the trunk, the needles, put that all below ground, and then stick your spruce cone above ground. And so it's the, yeah, you know, the fruiting structure, yeah, of something that's much larger.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's what we mostly focus on. And so we notice those. It's pretty easy, unless you, like, pick up a, you know, piece of wood or plastic, and you see the, you can sometimes then see the growth. It's just kind of cobwebby white, mostly.
Yeah, so those are like mycelial rhizomorphs, mm-hmm, and that's when there's a lot of mycelium kind of like bound together. Normally these cells are, you know, 1 to 2 microns wide, which is a micron is a thousandth of a millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, extremely small, maybe 8 to 10 microns long. So the smallest you can see of a naked eye is about 100 microns.
Yeah.
So, you know, really, they're really small cells,
yeah.
But they're stretching out. You know, everything is covered with them out,
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And I, like, every once in a while, I'll pull up bark and see these kind of runners of things going on. And, well, like, things are just, I guess it's just growing up through in that. But
the xylem layer.
Okay, so that's where maybe it's the weakest thing to start with.
That's where some, so like, yeah, like armillaria, which, mm-hmm, is a third group of fungi, which you didn't mention, the parasitic fungi.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So there's a small percentage of fungi which are parasites. You know, they're out there to killing their host. But, you know, a good parasite doesn't kill all of its hosts.
It, yeah,
keeps some of them alive. So, you know, the common one, the honey mushroom or armillaria, will send up these really thick, like shoestring-like rhizomorphs, these thick black rhizomorphs, mm-hmm, in between, you know, through the xylem layer, between the bark and the wood, and kind of like take all the nutrients that the tree is sending up from the roots or down from the needles, and it'll take all that nutrients and live off of it and kill the tree fairly quickly.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one example of it. There are examples of, you know, fungi getting into trees. If a tree branch breaks off, it's an open wound, and, you know, spores can land on there and start growing. And the tree does have, like, methods of trying to get rid of that fungus, and it'll like, put up these, like, blocking walls of cells that will try to keep the fungus out, and sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. And a lot of fungal parasites are fairly slow acting, at least in the plant world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your polypores can be living on that tree for a long time, then start fruiting. And I, you know, as the tree gets older and loses, you know, some of the power it had to fight them off, they'll start showing up more and more.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the trees you see that are blown over have these root decayers that have probably been there for 20, 30, 50 years. And then just it gets to a point where it weakens the tree too much, and then they blow over.
Yeah, and so, you know, I guess we've talked about the mycorrhizal and the rotters and parasites, and it just, like, it's a big umbrella of fungal diversity. Like, when we talk about fungus in the big picture, mostly what we're talking about is what we see as macro fungi, I guess.
Yeah.
And but there's a whole host, like, I suppose there's single cell from that size to...
Yeah, from the whole, the macro fungi, yeah, the mushroom aspect of it,
yeah,
it's probably 10% of the fungi,
oh, okay,
out there.
All right.
So there's powdery mildews, there's yeast, you know, molds, rust, lichens.
Mm-hmm.
That's a complex relationship between fungi and algae or cyanobacteria. So all of that is, you know, a completely different aspect. There's a large group of these perennomycetes, which are little black specks on pretty much anything you would look at out there.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, mushrooms are such a small part of the fungal kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the part we see.
Right, right. And I, you know, I think I showed you a picture the other day, not a great picture, but just like I've noticed this over the years on the spruce sap, and it's this black, and at first I just thought the sap was turning black. And then I started noticing a couple times that it was fuzzy, and it's just little tiny black stalks with like a powder puff at the end, kind of a puffball thing at the end. And I guess that's, you know, some type of fungus. But I'm not, you know, I don't know what kind or, but
yeah, most likely what's called a sooty mold.
Oh, okay.
And so, I mean, once you start, microfungi is a whole different world.
Yeah.
I mean, you can sit behind the microscope for hours and see fungi on everything. And I mean everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's no shortage to fungi.
It's kind of a fascinating world, you know, a world of all the diversity and stuff that they have there and just the different ways that they make their living, so to speak. You know, it seems like fungi do just about anything that anybody's ever seen anything do, almost. Just like what we see is so much just the small portion of what's going on sort of behind the scenes. And like for me, I enjoy going out and like learning to recognize things and around here, I don't know. And it's fun to understand, I guess, what's going on in the background if somebody knows, like if they've learned about it and can share it. I'm probably not going to discover that information on my own for the most part. But in terms of like just field ID and that kind of thing, learning to recognize what's around, do you have a sense? I mean, I guess this is your first time in Sitka.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And you spent some time in Girdwood and of course down in the lower 48. And like, what's this, your sense of like how many species a person can expect of the macrofungi that are relatively easy to notice and learn to recognize?
It depends on how obsessive you are on it. You know, if you really want to know everything out there, it's going to be a lifetime and you're never going to know.
Yeah.
But for this area, there's probably a couple hundred species that are fairly common in this area that if you put some time in, you can learn them.
Mm-hmm.
It's always difficult getting started with fungi. You know, so here's this group that they're everywhere, and the fact that they're growing there, but you're not always seeing them. So even though they're there 24/7, you know, every single day of the year, they're growing there. You may only see them for a week every 3 years.
Yeah.
Because they're only sending up their, you know, their fruiting body, the mushroom part. Sometimes if you don't get the weather right, it could be years before you see a species again. So, but they're still there thriving on their ground. So that's part of the problem. You have a relatively short window, especially in this area, for finding them. And then the other aspect is if you've never done any birding before, you still know what a gull is.
Right.
You know, you have a baseline that you're not even aware that you have, that you have a starting point. And with mushrooms, you don't have that starting point. You know, you don't know that Trichathelm abietinum is your most common macrofungus in these woods here. It's on pretty much every single dead log. It's a nondescript polypore that when it's fresh, it has like a violet underside and the caps are usually covered with a little bit of an algae, you know, greenish color. But, you know, you can go out there and see that every single day of the year here.
Yeah.
But you have no idea what it is if you don't spend quite a bit of time investing into seeing, you know, what's growing here. So just the whole aspect of starting off with birds is you have something you already know without even knowing that you know it. With mushrooms is you're really starting from zero.
And so I guess, and I don't know if you have advice for folks that are interested in learning, like what I've always tried to do is just the things that I keep seeing, I try to figure out what they are, and then I try to look for things that are different. Like they don't look the same, so it must be something different. It isn't always something different, but I think bear's bread, you know, and then starting to notice the different, like, oh, not all these, one of them you can draw on and the other one you can't draw on, and that sort of thing. Is there kind of groups maybe that folks should look for to kind of start to begin that sorting, like into goals or?
Yeah, I mean, learn the different, you know, the first thing is, you know, learn gilled mushrooms from poured mushrooms, you know, learn tough woody polypores from boletes, you know, so just start splitting these things into different groups and, you know, break it. As soon as you can break stuff down to smaller groups, it's easy to find. Start with the big flashy stuff. You know, if something is big and showy, it's going to be a lot easier to identify than something that's little and brown.
Yeah.
You know, there's a large diversity of little brown mushrooms, and they're impossible to identify.
Yeah.
So if you start with stuff that's, you know, got some, you know, it got some pizzazz to it, it's easier to match it up with what you see in books and, you know, get as many identification books or resources that you can. So for this area, Steve Trudell's Mushrooms of the Pacific Northwest works really good. Kate Mohan and Steve Trudell did a smaller pamphlet for Mushrooms of the National Forest of Southeast Alaska or South Central Southeast Alaska. That's a pretty good resource. And then there's a computer program called Matchmaker, which is a Pacific Northwest key to mushrooms. So Google Matchmaker mushrooms and you'll find it. If you just Google Matchmaker, you'll find something else.
Yes.
Could be what you're looking for too. But so look for the Matchmaker mushroom key. And that's something that you just like plug in. Like it has a red cap with white warts on it. It has a veil, the skirt on the stalk. And you plug that in, you'll get the matches, and it'll closely match Amanita muscaria, your fly agaric. So, you know, you just pick out some really distinctive features about that mushroom and match it up to what's there. And that's a really good resource for this area.
Okay. Yeah, and I suppose part of the challenge of learning anything new, really, but fungi seem to have a fairly specialized lingo for some aspects. And so is there a way to kind of shorten that process, or is it just simply a matter of spending time? And it's always helpful to go with somebody who knows, I suppose, and kind of work with them and learn it that way.
Just spend time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I've been doing mushrooms for years. I kind of forgotten about plants. And then this past summer, I had a job doing plant surveys for National Forest down in California. And I had to, like, relearn all these terms. And if you're dedicated to it, if you're doing it every day, I mean, you learn one new term a day, you'll have it down in a fairly short amount of time.
Yeah.
But I mean, just for basics, you know, the basic structures of mushrooms, it's fairly easy. It won't take you all that long.
Yeah.
You know, and then as you get more into it, you look at them more, you'll just start noticing small differences between stuff and be like, oh yeah, that's, you know, the difference like between gill attachment, like a notch versus a broadly attached gill. And, you know, these little features really add up and tell you exactly what your mushroom is. And over time, you'll pick that up, you know, if you're dedicated to it fairly quickly.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, my experience with a lot of things is the hard part's getting identified in the first place, not recognizing it once you know what it is. Like a lot of things are pretty recognizable. But actually trying to work through the process of the key and that kind of thing is challenging, especially if you're kind of a novice.
Yeah, I mean, and especially if you have nobody around to, like, back up the fact that this is correct or not.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when I was keying out Carricks this past summer, you know, the sedges, it was like, okay, key's out here, but I don't know if I'm right or wrong.
Yeah.
You know, that's an aspect a lot of people are going to have with mushrooms. You know, here's this mushroom. I think it's this, but, you know, if it's not this, who can tell me why it is this or not? And so, you know, the mushroomobserver.org is a website where if you take a good quality photograph of it and kind of like post it up there, people can generally tell you what it is. It, like any online mushroom communities, they're, you know, they take some getting used to.
Yeah.
I would stay away from Facebook groups. And that's kind of like turned Mushroom ID into this. It's a really strange.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I would recommend not using that. Use Mushroom Observer because that way it'll give you it's a database that, you know, keeps records of. So we have very little idea what's growing in South Central Alaska. There's been very little collecting done in this area.
Yeah.
So there's just very few records. And if we had more people going out there and finding stuff and posting it on there, we could get a much better idea of range of some of these fungi. And then with that, have a better understanding of why they're in one place and not in another place.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of an interesting issue. You know, I've spoken to other, or one guy I've had on the show before who's interested in marine invertebrates. He's like, You know, you'll notice the Ranger maps always end at a Marine station, and that's just because that's where people look. So that was the last place they found it, and they probably extend, you know, one direction or the other from there, but nobody's really looked. And it's even more so, I imagine, for fungi, where I think there's a website that I guess mentioned it to Kitty, and she sent me the link to it, and I took a look at it, and I just pulled up a map and asked for all the records from Southeast Alaska, and I think Southeast, there was something like 700 records of fungi, which is not very many considering the size and the diversity that one would expect to be here. And so, it's you know, I suppose in the end, I don't know what they want for collection, like serious collections. I suppose it's dried specimens or frozen for DNA kind of stuff. But it's
dried specimens.
Dried specimens.
But that's for serious. Right. Like, you don't need, I mean, a photograph will generally do.
Yeah.
And so there is a big push saying that, you know, without a specimen, it's just a rumor. But I don't agree with that. Because if you have a photograph of a chanterelle from here, we'll know that the chanterelle is growing here. If you don't even have a photograph, how are we even going to know?
Right.
So, I mean, a photograph is the first step. So the website that Kitty told you about is a website called michaelportal.org.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a digital record of all the major fungal herbariums.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the, you know, spots where specimens have been collected and stored for North American fungi. And you can, like, plug in a location and then get all the collections from that area. So these are records that have a specimen backing up this record.
Yeah.
And so it's a really valuable resource to kind of, like, find out, you know, what's growing in a region.
Because
you've had a mycologist in that area who's gone and collected these things, and then, you know, you'll have a record from that area. But for this area, I mean, if you look at the range maps of a lot of these things, there'll be, you know, they'll be down in BC and Washington, and then there'll be another record from Cordova or Sitka, or, you know, without a record in Sitka. But,
right.
You know, if you connect the dots, which in most cases you can usually do if it's continuous habitat, you know, it's supposed to be here. It probably is here, just people haven't looked for it.
Yeah. And it's, I guess, one of the other things that's interesting to me about the sort of the whole challenge of learning a place and learning about the diversity of it is, you know, there's a lichenologist, Toby Sprabilli, I think his name is, and he did a workshop here. He also worked on a project with lichens on the Klondike National Park. And I think they found like 2,000 species of lichens. And it's not a big park, and it's not a place that you'd expect to have a lot of diversity. I mean, this was including the crusts and so forth.
Yeah.
And he said part of the challenge was that so many things, either, you know, you end up finding things that aren't known from North America or aren't even described, and you try to fit them into the keys. And so he said one of the things to do is you always have to try and be aware that this may not be something that's in the key that you're using. And so it seems like that could be a challenge sometimes with fungi as well. If you use the key, like there's things that are not yet described that are not that hard to find, for example, or you know, I guess you were telling me earlier before we started recording about, like, a lot of fungi in North America were given European names just because that was all they had access to, and so they just assumed that they were the same thing because it sort of fit the description. But we're finding now that that is, in many, if not most cases, not accurate or not correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, so a lot, you know, if you go back 100 years or so, you got to remember that a lot of these North American mycologists, that, you know, what they had was this brief written description of a fungus, and they said, okay, the one I'm finding here looks similar. You know, it matches that description. It's, you know, so for your chanterelle, it's orange. It has, you know, it doesn't have true gills. It has more like blade like ridges, and, you know, it got to be the golden chanterelle. So, you know, that worked for 7,500 years or so. But then as soon as you started looking closer, and nowadays with DNA, so that's really, you know, turned taxonomy on its head in every single field. But it's just an additional tool to say, okay, well, you know, not only do we have that, we have colored photographs at our fingertips, you know, the whole internet. You can pull up a picture of a chanterelle from Europe, a chanterelle from Eastern North America. And so what's happened is, you know, what we used to call Chanterelle sabarius, the golden chanterelle, when you start looking at it closer, it's probably about 30 species across North America. And so every region has its own chanterelle, and a lot of regions have multiple species of these chanterelles. And they're all dumped under the whole, you know, the same name.
Yeah.
And so once you look closer with new tools, you realize that these things are not the same. You know, some of them are pale yellowish colored and growing with hardwood. Some are pinkish colored growing with conifers. You know, your Pacific golden chanterelle grows with a lot of different conifers. So that's Cantharellus formosa. It's not described probably about 40 years ago now. So it's not a new name. It just has different aspects to it. If you go further south into California, you have this giant golden chanterelle that's growing with live oak. That's, you know, now known as Cantharellus californicus. But 40 years ago, these were all considered Cantharellus siberius.
So it was just considered a very variable species.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. And I guess that's part of the, you know, for myself, in many different groups that I've looked at, you know, and I'm trying to learn what's here, part of the challenge is identifying what variation is enough variation. And it depends on the group, and it depends on the particular characters within that group sometimes as to whether it indicates. And I'm curious, like with these, like the chanterelles you mentioned, it sounds like a lot of these, you know, looking back, like they're not that hard to tell apart in the field either once you realize that these aren't the same thing.
Once you've seen them from different places. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if you never travel, you know, if you see the same chanterelle every day, that's going to be your idea of a chanterelle. But if you see chanterelles from East Coast, from West Coast, from the Southeast, you see them from all these different regions, or you get photographs from all these different regions, you'll notice differences to them. And so, I mean, so there's fairly major differences to some of these things. And, you know, for years, it's just like mushrooms were considered variable. Spores travel around the world, so on and so forth. And we're finding out a lot of that's not true.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a lot of variations, because you have a species complex. You know, so to go back to a plant analogy, this summer we had this Stellaria, which is a chickweed. And so one of them that we are looking for, Stellaria obtusa, is a rare species. And the only difference from Stellaria cuta was it had ciliate margin to the leaf axil, which means it had a few little hairs coming up out of the leaf axil. And that's pretty much the only way you could tell these things apart. So here we have these plants where botanists have split them based on hairs coming out of the leaf axis. And we have these mushrooms, which, you know, one of them's like this 2-pound bright orange thing growing in California under live oak compared to this really slender little yellowish thing on the East Coast. And we were happy throwing that under the same name, you know, the same chanterelle name. But with plants, we really looked at them closer.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that had to do with a lot of the early botanists in North America were Europeans coming over here with kind of a sense of what their plants looked like back home and seeing the things here and realizing that they were different and giving them new names. But a lot of the early North American mycologists were trained here, didn't have any idea of what the European stuff looked like, just had these brief written descriptions of them, you know, no photographs, and said this is close enough for ours and use that name. And that aspect was, you know, really continued to being used around here. And the problem is there's no funding for taxonomy, So especially in mycology. So we continue to have little idea of what we actually have here. And slowly but surely, I mean, little groups have been, you know, peck away at them, and eventually we'll know. But there's been a push to get a North American mycoflora done, but, you know, it's all talk right now. There's no funding for it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you have $20 million to chip in, we will know what we have here.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess part of what makes me, you mentioned the history a little bit of how it differed between mycologists and botanists. Has mycology always been kind of a smaller community, the folks that are interested in mycology and taxonomy of fungi and that?
Yeah, it's always been smaller, and it's always gotten less funding.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what does get funded in mycology is mostly plant pathology.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's destroying your plants that are money crops.
Yeah.
Or forest. It's fairly, I mean, wood decay fungi are fairly well known.
Yeah.
Because if it's destroying your timber tree, then you got to know what it is and how to deal with it.
Yeah.
How to control it.
How to kind of prevent it. You're listening to a conversation I recorded with Noah Siegel and Alyssa Allen for the Sitka Nature Show. And this wraps up the portion where I was speaking predominantly with Noah. And for the rest of the conversation, I'll be mostly speaking with Alyssa. And so I wanted to go ahead and introduce her a little more. She's been working on mushroom dyeing for some years and travels around giving workshops, teaching people how to dye animal fibers with mushroom-derived dyes and some fungus as well. So I was it was fun to talk to her. I'll start joining the conversation with her where I have started to ask her about a fungus that's found here called Dyer's polypore. I know, like, it's a root, or what did I? It's like it only grows at the base of trees. Is that right? Yeah, and it's a big. It's kind of colorful in itself. Actually, the first time I saw it growing, it was coming up out of the ground, sort of. It wasn't right on the wood, but I think like the buttress kind of had been covered over. And actually, when it was first coming up, I thought, that looks like toasted marshmallows. And we kept going back because I was like, this is weird. And it eventually formed this big like set of pancakes-looking thing, the way that it grew. But what's interesting to me about it is, like, I've learned a little bit more about it since. It's called Dyer's polypore because you get different colors out of it. And I don't know how much you know about how that works, but I'd be curious to know a little bit more about like the dyes and the colors that come out of. I mean, just as an example, I'm sure there are a lot of different kind of mushrooms that you get colors out of as well.
Yeah, so Dyer's polypore is one of my favorite fungi to work with because it has a lot of dye in it. You're able to use a relatively small amount of fungus to the amount of fiber that you're dyeing. If you are getting really young specimens that still have lots of pigment still in them, you can take one part of the fungus. I usually dry my fungi before dyeing with them so that I can come up with an idea of how much fungus to use versus how much fiber I'm using. This gives me kind of a weight ratio. And so you can use one part dried fungus to five parts of dry fiber, which is a very little amount of fungus to a large amount of fiber. And the Dyer's polypore is one that you want to get when it's young because the pigments are really water soluble. So the longer it's out in weather like this, the less pigment you're going to have from that fungus.
And so are these like the pigments, are they chemicals that are just happen to be in the mushroom?
Yeah, they are. And you can't always judge a dye mushroom by its color.
Yeah.
So some mushrooms that produce really interesting colors on wool, like blue green, there'll be an orange mushroom that stains your hands orange. But when it's treated, when the pH is shifted or whatnot, you get these totally different colors that you just wouldn't expect.
So I don't know if, like, you don't have to know this information to be able to dye. I'm just kind of like a little bit of a nerd sometimes. So, are there people that have researched the chemistry of this and like understand what's doing the color? And I guess I'm also kind of curious as to like, why are these things in the mushrooms? Are they some sort of like, defense mechanism or, you know, the chemicals that are in there?
Those are all really good questions. And there's not a lot understood and there's not a lot in English. There has been some research in Scandinavian fungi, but it's, as far as I know, it hasn't been translated.
And
so,
and we probably don't read Swedish or Finnish. So, right. And the other part about it, I guess, is that it ends up being pretty experimental. I suppose it's like, well, here's a new mushroom. Let's see what it does, kind of thing.
There's some different approaches you can take. You can just throw some mushrooms in a pot with some water, and throw some fiber in there and see what happens. And you'll have variable results. You might totally miss your target. You might, because you don't know what your target is. So certain pigments work better with a pH shift. And you won't get your optimal color unless you shift that pH. So to do testing on a fungus that you've never tried before, you're going to want to test it with a neutral extraction, so with just water. And then you'll want to test it with with a little bit of alkalinity in there. So I shift my pH, if I'm going alkaline, up to about pH 9. I use little pH papers to check this. Or shift it down. I'll do another extraction with pH 4 by using vinegar. And those three tests, neutral, alkaline, and acidic, will usually tell me what my target recipe should be.
Yeah. And so you so I suppose it's kind of a mix of experience and things that have worked with other things and then experimentation. Like, and how do you decide what's like a candidate mushroom to experiment with, or can any of them just sort of potentially be colorful?
I have a lot of years of experimenting mm-hmm. with this, so you know I go after certain groups of fungi that I know have species that have produced dye.
Yeah.
But you can really test any mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
A good thing to know is that using mineral salts like alum, aluminum sulfate, and iron ferrous sulfate will have an effect on the color. So with the Dyer's polypore, Phaeolus schwainitzii, if you use no additives, you're going to get kind of a straw yellow color dye. If you throw some alum in there, it's going to be bright golden or yellow.
Yeah.
And if you throw some ferrous sulfate in there, you're going to get beautiful forest green. So just knowing that you can get a lot of variation from that fungus will help you.
Yeah. No, I suppose that's kind of the fascinating. I suppose it's kind of exciting sometimes. Like you don't know, and then you get this amazing color out of it and that, you know, and I don't know how many people, like, I have no concept of the community of fungal fiber artists, you know, that are looking at dyeing and doing coloring.
The interesting thing about mushroom dyes is that they haven't been documented for very mm-hmm. long. So the first documented, recipes for mushroom dyes came out in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
So unlike plants and roots and insects and mollusks and lichens even, which have been used pretty much as long as people have been making clothing forever, mushroom dyes were relatively not used as far as we know.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that even archaeologists and people who study textiles that, you know, are found in primitive places like caves and such are not finding fungal pigments were used. So what we know is what's been documented, and a lot of that comes from experience from plant dyers. So Miriam C. Rice was the person who popularized mushroom dyeing in the 1970s in Mendocino, and she was a plant dyer before she dedicated her life to mushroom dyeing.
Yeah.
And so she took the tools that she already had at hand. She used mordants and plant dyeing, and so she brought those to the table with the mushroom dyes. And really just kind of laid the groundwork for experimenting with these things. And I don't know if I'm second generation mushroom dyer or what, but, you know, I've contributed my own experience and experiments with these things.
So are there places, like if somebody is curious about getting into, I mean, because it seems like it's a pretty low bar to entry, right? Because you go out and you find some mushrooms and you put them in a pot. I don't know. Do you usually heat them up?
You want to simmer your mushrooms for about an hour
mm-hmm.
with your fiber. And like I said, trying those three pHs and then playing around with the mordants. If you make some little testers up, you can just throw them in and see what you get.
Yeah.
And before you like throw your whole fancy wool sweater in there, you can just, you know, test it on a piece of string, on a piece of wool.
Yeah, yeah.
And wool is the ideal fiber. It's what takes the dyes the best. Silk also works, but it's takes the dyes a little differently. And then you get into cotton and linen and hemp, and cellulose fibers like that don't really take the dyes at all.
Oh, so is it's not possible, or is it like a mordant thing?
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah.
There are people who are really trying to work with getting cellulose fibers to take dyes better.
Mm-hmm.
But the wool, all you have to do is wash the wool and throw it in there, and it takes it like really brilliantly.
Yeah.
Where cotton, you're going to have to like treat it with some pretty harsh chemicals to get it to accept the dye.
Interesting. So when a piece of wool is dyed, and then it like changes color. Does that wash out over time, or
it's permanent? With mushroom dyes, it's light fast and wash mm-hmm. fast and everything.
Wow. Yeah. So if somebody wanted to just start experimenting on their own, I mean, it sounds like it's a really super simple recipe. But if they want to like look in and learn from what other people have done? Are there online places to go look? Or I know you do workshops. You're doing a workshop here, and it sounds like you kind of do them up and down the coast, at least the West Coast, over the course of the year.
I teach workshops just about anywhere I can.
Yeah.
And I like to go to new places to study the dye palette, the mushroom dye palette mm-hmm. that exists. So I ideally go to a place and get to hang out in the woods for a couple weeks during mushroom season or a week and take what I find there and test it and see what kind of fungal dye palette exists. So it's been really fun coming here to Sitka and finding that you guys have some of my favorite dye mushrooms.
Oh, yeah. So what do we have here that are...
Well, you have a fun little cortinarius that grows with the spruce. Mm-hmm. So cortinarius is this little brownish mushroom. It's a huge genus. The ones that we use for dyeing have really brightly colored gills.
I've seen almost a continuum from a dark sort of maroon to more of a kind of almost cinnamon golden color, and then right. and then kind of some in between, basically.
So, and this group of fungi is called the Dermosibi mm-hmm. group of cortinarius, and so you'll find ones with they all kind of have a similar colored cap. But then when you flip them over, they'll have like bright yellow gills, bright orange gills, or bright red gills. And there's some rare species that probably occur here that have just bright red caps. But all of those fungi in the Dermosibi group provide us with some of the most color fast and beautiful reds and oranges and yellow dyes.
Yeah, I think Kitty Labowney experimented with those 1 year and got this kind of a red pink dye out of the, like the wool dyed that color from some of those. But I don't know. I think that was just like hot water and soaking.
They're really easy to get their color out of. So my favorite one that grows around here that I already was able to find was called Cortinarius aurantiobasis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like bright, bright orange underneath the gills. And boil that mushroom with a little bit of fiber and a splash of vinegar, and you'll get like safety orange.
Wow! Yeah,
dye. Yeah,
that's kind of interesting. And so what kind of like are there like sort of online communities that people can kind of hook up with to sort of learn more about it?
I have my website is mycopigments.com, mm-hmm. and I have some information and resources there, and then. There's a couple of things on Facebook, a couple of groups that I've made on Facebook. So one is called Mushroom and Lichen Dyers United. And that's a place for people to share their experiences and experiments and just kind of show and talk about what they're trying out. There's a lot of people who have some experience, so it's not just me answering questions.
Right.
There's a handful of people that are there to kind of help out. And then the other resource that is on Facebook is called the Mushroom Dyers Trading Post. And that's a place where if you either are a forager and you're out, you know, and picking mushrooms for commercially or whatever, and say it's a bad year for chanterelles or something, or you're up to your elbows in lobster mushrooms, you might be able to look for dye mushrooms and trade. I encourage people to just trade only. But you might be able to provide them to dyers. And dyers can trade things back.
Yeah, like right.
Mushroom-dyed hat.
Right. Or, no, that seems kind of like a cool way to do it. And so the particular types of mushrooms, you know, I suppose there's ones that people want that are easy to get in some places, not so easy to get in other places and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, well, Cordova has, like, smoked salmon. You guys probably have smoked salmon, too.
Yeah.
It's a real hot trading item.
Yeah,
so you can pretty much get anything you want with that.
I see. Interesting. Yeah. The
blue green dye mushrooms, red dye mushrooms. You just say, you know, hey, I've got some smoked salmon. I'm looking for some dye mushrooms. What do you got?
Yeah, that's fun. Well, then another thing I was kind of curious about, you mentioned that most, it sounds like, well, with the dyers polypore and all of them, are these things, the dyes come out even after they're dry, or there's something you have to use fresh?
Most. Like 99% of the mushrooms work just as well dried as they do fresh. There's a couple exceptions to that, but they're not the best colors. They're interesting. And I mean, that's what makes natural dyeing and especially mushroom dyeing so fun is that there's some mad science to it.
Yeah.
So you can get excited getting a smoky violet color, even though it's maybe not the best color in the world. it's just like the magic of getting the process right to get a brown mushroom to give out that purple color.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it's kind of like the intermittent reinforcement thing, you know, it's like probably I imagine sometimes you get nothing out of it. It's sort of like looks like it's been stained with tea or something.
Yeah.
And other times you get these bright colors and you're like, amazing. Yeah. So yeah, it seems like kind of a fun way to experiment and just another way to appreciate, the fungi that are around all the time that are, you know, really easy to kind of just take for granted. You know, you walk around and it's just another mushroom.
I got into it because it does give you something else to look for. I was never good at looking for or finding edibles. I'd find a handful of chanterelles or other people were filling their baskets, probably because I was too busy looking at other things.
Yeah.
Trees, plants, bugs, slugs.
Yeah.
So when I found out about using mushrooms for dyes, it just gave me, you know, something else to look for in the forest.
Yeah, and I suppose the nice thing about that, too, is it's a way to, I mean, you can collect them and dry them and then experiment for the rest of the year.
Exactly.
With what you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking for almost an hour now, so I want to thank you guys for coming in. And Noah, I should ask you also, so your book is about done, not quite to the publisher yet, or is it coming out soon?
No, it's at the publisher. It's going through the copy edit stage right now, so... by the end of this week, we'll be done. All the writing is done for it. So it's just a matter of doing layout and getting it printed now.
Oh, good.
So it's due out sometime next year, July or so next year. So you should have it by mushroom season next year.
All right. So sounds like it should be a good reference for us here as well. You said I'm sure there'll be stuff in there that isn't going to occur here.
Yeah, you're going to have there's a lot in it that does not occur here, but most of your common stuff that's here will be in that book.
Will be in that book.
Because we have really good coverage for the north coast of California, which are, you know, the same mushrooms that are here.
Yeah.
So, like I said earlier, I don't think there's been anything I've seen the past 3 days here, which I haven't seen in California.
Yeah.
It's a really similar habitat to the north coast of California habitat.
Well, and I haven't seen your talk yet, but I've heard that you have a reputation for good mushroom photography. So I'm guessing that your book will be very nice that way as well. Not that you need to sort of confirm that for yourself, but that, you know, part of your goal as a photographer of mushrooms has been to make it useful for identification as well as still being aesthetically, you know, satisfying.
Yeah. So the key for you know, the mushroom guide photography, the key is to show all features of that mushroom in one photograph.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that'll include a couple growing as they're growing and, you know, getting young immature specimens in the same photo, showing the underside, showing the stalk, you know, the type base. So, you know, just getting all the parts of the mushroom necessary for identification in one photo.
Yeah.
So it takes some time to set that up.
Yeah, I imagine so. You know, with my limited experience taking pictures of mushrooms and and finding them. And so, yeah, I appreciate you guys coming in and visiting with me during your trip here. And, well, hopefully you'll get to come back in a maybe somewhat less rainy season someday. I know it's been a little wet since you've been here. But any other things you'd like to say before we close out?
Yeah, just thank you very much for having us, and thank you to Kitty Labonte for organizing, getting us here.
And the Stunts Foundation for supplying me with some grant money to fly around up here.
All right.
Yeah, because we came from Massachusetts, so it's a long way from home.
Yeah, that's true. That is a long way from home. Well, I appreciate you guys coming in. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Noah Siegel and Alyssa Allen. They were in town as part of the Natural History Seminar Series. Noah gave a talk and did a mushroom walk, and Alyssa ran a workshop on mycopigments. I want to thank them for taking some time out of their trip here to visit with me in the studio, and thank you for joining me this week on the Sitka Nature Show again. As always, you can find recordings of past shows if you go to sitkanature.org/raven or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. I love to hear what folks are seeing out there and sharing up observations, so please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can leave a post on the Facebook page. It's great to hear what's going on in this fall season, so thanks for that. And I'll look forward to being back in a couple weeks. This has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW Sitka.